Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Hellas Foundation. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, we'll be taking a look back at the literary year 2019. Has been a rich, full literary year in New Orleans, and in this episode of The Reading Life, we'll take a look back at highlights in recent books and events. The year got off to a great start with the publication of one of the most anticipated novels in recent memory, Maurice Carlos Ruffin's We Cast a Shadow, the story of a racialized future some 50 years hence, nominated for a Penn Open Book Award. Ruffin began a new chapter this year as a professor at LSU, and in 2020 will be the next John and Renee Grisham, writer-in-residence at Ole Miss.
New Orleans informs the book, obviously. I think I was originally inspired by Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man. Mm-hmm. And I remember reading that book in college and thinking that this book so perfectly describes how it feels to be an African-American in America. And I think that around the time that Trayvon Martin was killed, those conversations around what happened to him, his murder, sort of combined in my mind. And I decided that I wanted to pursue that path and write a book about a very American city with a very American problem. Any good novel is something that asks questions. And so I do want people to read the book and kind of wonder why hadn't they thought about some of these things before. I think that education is so important in our lives. I'm a lifelong student. I've got several degrees because I love to learn about the world and about humans. But I do think that people should ask, why haven't they learned more about some of these things when they were either in high school or in grade school, or even in college? I think that often history is sort of collapsed and reduced to the sort of simplified version of itself. And then you watch television and you see riots or you see people being shot for no apparent reason. You wonder, why has it happened? Mm-hmm. I think that once you begin to read books like Michelle Alexander's New Jim Crow,
right,
or you know, similar books like that, you get an impression for the things you have not learned in your life. And so I think that this book should be maybe a portal towards going on a personal journey to make yourself more intelligent and more empathetic on these topics.
Sarah Broom's The Yellow House, a memoir, the story of her family's life in a house on Wilson Street in New Orleans East, won a National Book Award and was named one of the year's top 10 books by the New York Times.
You know, this is so hard. This is the heart of it all, really, because the thing I always remind myself is that my mother bought this house when she was 18, 19 years old, with every cent she had. It was her dream. It was a place she loved. It was a place she built up. It was a place she raised her 12 children in. The house was a repository for us. It was the witness to our lives. When I see any house missing from any landscape, whether it's in New Orleans, whether it's in Detroit, whether it's in Cambodia, something is shaken in me, because very, very quickly, I think about the stories that that house contained. I think about the family who's been displaced from that house. And so for me, that was really the work to start to think about what happens to all of us when these places we know and these places we love are suddenly gone, even if they're still there and transfigured, but mm-hmm. gone in some sort of way.
Albert Woodfox's Solitary, My Story of Transformation and Hope, was a memoir of his life as the man who was kept in solitary confinement in Angola for more than 40 years. Nominated for a National Book Award and one of the New York Times 100 Notable Books of the Year, it was selected by the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities as the Humanities Book of the Year as well. In a moving chapter in this memoir, he talked about the books he read.
my greatest achievement. After years in prison and solitary confinement, I had experienced all the emotions the Louisiana Department of Public Safety and Correction wanted from me. Anger, bitterness, the thirst to see someone suffer. The way I was suffering, the revenge factor, all that. But I also became something they didn't want or expect. Self-educated, I could lose myself in a book. Reading was a bright spot for me. Reading was my salvation. Libraries and universities and schools from all over Louisiana donated books to Angola. And for once, the willful ignorance of the prison administration paid off for us, because there were a lot of radical books in the prison library, books we wouldn't even be allowed to get through the mail, books we never could have afforded to buy, books we had never heard of. Herman King and I first gravitated to books and the authors that dealt with politics and race. George Jackson, Frantz Fanon, Malcolm X, Marcus Garvey, Steve Biko, Eldridge Cleaver, Soul on Ice, J.A. Rogers, From Superman to Man. We read anything we could find on slavery, communism, socialism, Marxism, anti-imperialism, the African independent movements, and independent movements from around the world. I would check off these books on the library order form and never expect to get them until they came. Leaning against my wall in the cell, sitting on the floor, on my bed, or at my table, I read.
Helen Prejean in River of Fire, My Spiritual Journey, described the evolution of her faith as she moved from obedience to activism.
Faith is such an evolving, growing thing. So faith then in the convent before Vatican II meant keeping the rule, praying together at the designated times, trying to do everything you did, the most ordinary tasks from mopping a floor, teaching kids, with love for God, and that every act that you did was equally pleasing to God. That because you're doing it out of obedience as a nun, that blessed everything. And so it takes time to see and to grow into. Not every act is equal. All acts should be done with love. But when there are crying needs in society and people are suffering, to get engaged in that is not the same as just doing an ordinary task like washing the dishes. Everything's important. So it was that awakening to justice, and not just practicing charity to the people around you or being pious and praying that God would solve the problems of the world and help the suffering people, but that prayer and faith ignites us to roll up our sleeves and be engaged. The pious way that you talk about it is to be the hands of Christ, to be the eyes of Christ. In the world, embodied, incarnate. But it was that waking up. I had to wake up to that, because the whole first part of my life as a nun was being charitable to people around me. And I didn't get the thing of that we need to be engaged in social justice. And here I was living in the suburbs of New Orleans. We had 10 major housing projects.
Right.
African-American people struggling against poverty and racism, redlining in the banks, police beating them up, all these things. But it could have been on Mars, because I was in a separate bubble. So I had to break out. And that's grace. It's grace that wakes us up.
Jamie Attenberg set her sixth novel, All This Could Be Yours, in New Orleans after moving here 4 years ago.
So for me, because I moved here full-time 4 years ago, for me it was kind of the safe way for me to start writing about New Orleans, to have these characters who were from outside of the city come in and witness the city from a fresh outsider perspective. Now, more characters from New Orleans sort of pop up in the book along the way. But for me, this was the way that I could give myself permission to write about New Orleans, I think, initially, because I was really scared to write about the city. Very protective of the city, as everyone is that lives here. You know, no matter how long you've lived here, you begin to feel very protective of this place. And so I just wanted to be able to do it justice, and I wanted to feel comfortable. And I sat on it really for a couple of years I mean, the first 2 years that I lived here, I didn't start writing about New Orleans. Mm-hmm. And I just was too scared to do it. And I was waiting. I really was waiting for somebody to give me permission. And then one day I woke up and realized no one was going to give me permission. I had to give permission to myself. And so that's, I think, how I got to the place of writing about these outsiders. I thought, well, start with what you know.
Yeah.
And that's what I knew coming in and being new in town.
Well, you said that you were worried about moving here, about making the place you went to get away, your home, and you were worried how that would work out.
It's worked out fine. I like it here.
I had a feeling.
It's worked out really. I mean, I have lived in New York for a really long time, for most of my adult life, actually, like 18 years, something like that. And I've traveled and lived all over the world in various places for months at a time and sort of checking out where I would want to move to. And New Orleans was the place that captivated me the most. Everyone feels this way, that when you come here, you're coming home. Mm-hmm. And I'm always happy to come home here. And I've been able to meet a lot of people in the writing community and make friends in my neighborhood. And so it's just been really wonderful for me to move here, even as this is a really complicated city in so many ways. Like, I don't view it with starry eyes at all. Like,
right.
I mean, that was an interesting thing, writing about this place and not wanting to write a starry-eyed version of it, but mm-hmm. also having it be a love letter to the city in a lot of ways. And I think one of the ways that I got around it being kind of this cliched version is that I had one character in particular who doesn't really like it here.
Uh-huh.
And so she, Barbara, who is Victor Tuckman's wife, she moved down here kind of unwillingly with Victor. Victor had, you know, they're sort of leaving this little scandal behind in their past, and they moved down here to get away from it because they had children down here who had moved down here. And Barbara moves down here and she sort of has to be convinced. And every time she does something that's sort of typically New Orleanian, she's kind of doesn't get it at all. Like, she goes to a crawfish boil and she's really grossed out. And she goes to, you know, Audubon Park and she's just like, birds, trees, dirt. She's wearing the wrong shoes always. So it was kind of fun to write about New Orleans that way from that perspective. And so I could still write about it lovingly, but also kind of teasingly at the same time.
Margaret Wilkerson Sexton and the Revisioners, which was also named one of the New York Times 100 notable books, drew on her own New Orleans childhood, creating women who are healers and hopers.
So Revisioner is a name that I made up. It's not a word that I've heard before. It's the idea that you can recreate your life, and you can even recreate your descendants' life through the way you handle whatever trials are sent to you in this lifetime. So the idea of healing and hope is not only pertinent to one generation, but it's woven through many, and it's always a possibility.
Samantha Downing made her mark with My Lovely Wife, a debut novel about a couple who takes up serial killing to spice up their marriage. She wrestled a bit with the problem of glamorizing murderers.
We're struggling right now because of our media with glorifying killers versus studying them versus not naming them at all, because naming them is what gives them so much fame and people want. And now there's a movement to not give their names on the news. At the same time, when a crime like that happens or when a serial killer comes along, they actually are the most interesting part of that equation, because the normal good people are normal good people that are not killing people. The one that breaks and becomes a serial killer for whatever reason, or is a psychopath or what have you, is the one you want to know more about. What makes them do that? What makes mm-hmm. them? So it's a double-edged sword, because you want to know what would make someone do that, but at the same time, you don't want to make them famous and glorify them.
Right. Nathaniel Rich, whose Losing Earth, A Recent History, is a history of climate change activism, wrote about something that matters to all of us here in New Orleans.
You can't live in New Orleans and have this not be part of your daily life, I think. We're constantly thinking about certainly the role of water, but I think in the coast and sea level rise and the vulnerability of living here. And yet we don't leave.
We don't.
And we love it, you know. And I think it's fun. And if anything, perhaps it gives life a greater intensity of feeling and excitement in some way. I mean, for better or worse. And down here. And I think that in some ways living here is a bit like living in the future. You know, we think of New Orleans as this city haunted by the past, but I think it also gives us this glimmer of the future, of what I think more people in other parts of the world will feel like in the future, when one has to incorporate these public crises into one's private and personal contemplations and figure out, well, where do we stand on all of this and how do we make sense of it all? And I think I've been asked that question a lot about this book. Well, how can you live in New Orleans? How can you think about all of this stuff and live in New Orleans? But I think that's ultimately a very human way of being, which is that you can be deeply despairing and pessimistic in your thoughts at one time and then deeply, you know, crazily optimistic and hopeful at others. And I think there's a balance in between there that each of us has to strike. And I think the crucial thing is just to be open to the complexity of it. And I feel like too much of the writing and thinking about climate change has been driven by an effort to simplify. Mm-hmm. And I ultimately don't feel that's an honest way of thinking or of living.
And if people really think about it, we're all living in New Orleans now, you know? Shocking.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, how do we make peace with that? And I think that's when I'm talking about some of the larger questions that haven't been, I think, answered or even posed about climate change. A lot of them have to do with how do we let this information, this terrifying information, into our personal lives? Mm-hmm. Do we just ignore it? Do we become obsessed? Or how do we strike the balance? And I think the first step is to speak about the problem honestly and openly and perhaps constantly.
Constantly, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Other notable nonfiction included Jesse Morgan Owens' Girl in Black and White, The Story of Mary Margaret Williams and the Abolition Movement. Nancy Eisenberg and Andrew Burstein chronicled The Problem of Democracy, The President's Atoms Confront the Cult of Personality.
We have always elevated certain individuals in the national imagination, and no one so much as the founding pantheon. And this is why we dwell so much on the cult of personality or cult of celebrity, as they viewed it. And John Adams, for example, not only had a big beef with Benjamin Franklin, whom he called the old conjurer, but he had a lot to say about George Washington, whom he respected.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things that makes looking at John and John Quincy Adams really refreshing and feels, you know, as if this is relevant for today, is, as I said, they didn't want, they felt democracy, you needed a system of checks and balances. You hear that in the news all the time today. You needed a strong Congress, a Congress that took its responsibilities seriously to reflect the interests of the people, not the interests of the party. And this is one of the tensions we see being played out today. And I think that with the cult of celebrity and the cult of personality, this is so relevant, and I think it's important for people today to realize that this has long been an issue that has informed popular politics. Once you make politics into entertainment, and by the time Andrew Jackson is getting elected, you know, at the polls, they have, you know, clever nicknames and campaign songs and parades, and they handed out food and alcohol at the polling places. Once you make it into entertainment, essentially you are going to put much more value on what is the manufactured traits of the candidate rather than talking about policy or, you know, substantive issues.
Daniel Brook wrote about The Accident of Color, a story of race and reconstruction.
The Accident of Color is a history book. It is about New Orleans and Charleston in the period immediately preceding the Civil War till the rise of Jim Crow around, let's say, 1890 is when the Separate Railcar Act segregating the railcars is passed in Louisiana. So it's that period. But at the same time, it's an introduction to these misfit metropolises filled with immigrants, people speaking different languages on the street, people coupled in all kinds of different ways, people from different continents meeting and having children together. And in many ways, if you squint, you could see a place like Miami or Houston today, a cosmopolitan immigrant stew. In a way, you can still see this in New Orleans, but it's kind of, the stew is settled a bit. It's like the second day soup where it all tastes like it's been blended together instead of where you still have all of the individual ingredients.
And Josh Levin explored the Queen, the forgotten life behind an American myth, the story of the woman behind the term welfare queen. Robert Azzarello is the author of 300 Years of Decadence, New Orleans Literature in the Transatlantic World. And T.R. Johnson went back all the way to the beginnings for New Orleans, a literary history. Giacomo, the Native Roots of Mardi Gras Indians by John McCusker and Shane Leaf was as colorful as its subjects. The Preservation Resource Center's Building on the Past, Saving Historic New Orleans by Danielle Del Sol, Susan Langenhenig, John Pope, and Chris Granger is a reminder of the treasures we see every day, just as Robert Brantley's Sacred Ground New Orleans Cemeteries served as a beautiful memento mori.
I wanted to have other people see the cemeteries like I see them. I see them as a very large outdoor museum.
Yes.
Some of the finest artwork in the city is in those cemeteries. I don't see the rigidity and the coldness of marble or granite. I don't see that.
Mm-hmm.
I see softness to it because I keep it in relationship to grass, trees, and the clouds. Everything around it is the total ambiance. It seems to give these tombs and their artwork life.
Yes.
And that was what I had tried to do.
Long enough.
And it's hard to say what the most fun book this year was, but Poppy Tooker's Drag Queen Brunch is a strong candidate for that award. We had a lot of memorable visitors in town this year, among them Colson Whitehead for the Nickel Boys, Ta-Nehisi Coates debuting his novel Water Dancer, Hillary Rodham Clinton and Chelsea Clinton talking about the Book of Gutsy Women, Judith Viorst contemplating her 90s, and best-selling authors Amor Towles and David Sedaris, along with Candace Bushnell. N.K. Jemison was the Zale Writer-in-Residence at Tulane University. And Megan Abbott and Sarah St. Vincent received the Diana Pinkley Prizes for Crime Fiction. Another well-deserved recognition came to Paul Willis, the executive director of both the Saints and Sinners Literary Festival and the Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival. He received a prestigious leadership award from the Publishing Triangle. Literary festivals abounded this year. The Poetry Festival continued its growth and is on track to grow an even larger international audience. Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival is well into its 30s, and Randy Fertel's Inspired Improvisation Festival hosted fascinating writers and thinkers. Happy Birthday, Mr. Faulkner continued in September. One Book, One New Orleans, under the leadership of Megan Holt, had a great year celebrating Vengeance by Zachary Lazar, with a special performance by the New Orleans Jazz Orchestra, performing work inspired by the book at Words and Music in November. Next year's One Book selection is New Orleans Griot, a Tom Dent reader, edited by Kalamu Yassalam. The Louisiana Book Festival celebrated a banner year, too, with the Louisiana Writer Award going to Richard Campanella. Next year, the calendar will grow even more crowded with the addition of the New Orleans Book Festival at Tulane University in March, chaired by Walter Isaacson and Cheryl Landrieu. One of the best new Only in New Orleans experiences this year was provided by Melba's Po' Boys, which began giving away books with po' boys at their restaurant on Elysian Fields. It's the tastiest author venue in town, and you can get your laundry done there, too. Kitchen Witch Books closed, a loss to all of us who love cookbooks, but Philippe La Mancusa is still making and selling his signature spice blends.
Thank you.
lost three important and influential figures this year. Children's book author, illustrator Baird Amos passed away October 6th at the age of 94. In addition to her own work, Baird taught many young writers at Tulane University. We also mourn the loss of distinguished journalist and founding mother of NPR and best-selling author Cokie Roberts, such an inspiring figure for women in every walk of life. She was the author of such beloved books as Founding Mothers, published also in an edition for young readers, as well as Capital Dames, We Are Our Mother's Daughters, Ladies of Liberty, and many more. And let's end on a note of grace. Ernest Gaines is an irreplaceable figure in New Orleans and Louisiana literature. He was the creator of the unforgettable Autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman, and was known as well for A Lesson Before Dying, such a beloved book, one of many. He was well honored in his lifetime, including being the recipient of a MacArthur Genius Grant. Here are some excerpts from my last interview with him in 2015. He died November 5th at the age of 86. He was not just a great writer, he was a great man, good and generous and wise.
Well, I read everything. I might start with George Bernard Shaw in the morning, and I'll go to maybe Tolstoy, I'll go to Hemingway, I'll Faulkner, I'll read from the Bible, and I read some of my own work. I read some poetry, I read different things. So I don't have a novel I'm following through all the way. Uh-huh. One writer I'm following through all the way. I just go in my library, I go in my study, and wherever I stop, I just take down a book and start reading it.
Thanks for being with us. Here's to a year of great reading in 2020. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Here in New Orleans, the College Book Arts Association Conference is coming up in New Orleans, January 2nd through 4th, 2020. If you'd like to volunteer, you can also attend the conference for free. Dates available are Thursday, January 2nd from 10 to 8 at Tulane, Friday, January 3rd from 8 to 8 at the Ace Hotel, and again, Saturday, January 4th from 8 to 9. Come see all the beautiful books and learn more about the book arts. On Saturday, the conference is free and open to the public from 1 to 4. To volunteer, write Amelia Bird at ameliabird@gmail.com. For more info, go to collegebookart.org. And if your New Year's resolution is to get serious about a writing life, check out next semester's offerings from the New Orleans Writers Workshop. The spring classes are up at neworleanswriters.com. And one book, One New Orleans, has announced its 2020 selection. New Orleans Griot, The Tom Dent Reader, edited by Kalamu Yassalam and published by UNO Press. Put that at the top of your reading list for the new year. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Engmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org.